Swami Lokeshwarananda. In 1965, Swami Lokeshwarananda was the secretary, head, of our educational complex at Narendrapur, a few miles south of Calcutta, an institution he had founded some 10 years before in another location. At that time, it consisted of a college, secondary schooling for classes 7 through 12, an academy for blind boys, a technical school, a village outreach program, and other things on a 150-acre campus. Before we speak of Narendrapur, however, it is necessary to explain the mental set which preceded these memoirs. I came to India from the Vedanta Society of Northern California. In the monastery, there, we thought of the ideal, the culmination of spiritual practice, as a life of withdrawnness, quiet contemplation, a life no longer motivated by ambition. That was my picture of the holy person. There were, of course, busy and active monks in the order, but perfected? One hardly thought so. At Belur Math, where I spent my first month in India, a tall, energetic, and talkative monk made his presence well known. He moved breezily from temple to office to dining hall, greeting familiarly everyone he met in loud and jolly tones, servants and dignitaries alike. With some prejudice, I pegged this monk as a wheeler-dealer, a common American expression. He surely was not representative of what I called high spiritual attainment. I think I even whispered to myself the hope that there would not be many here of this type. I little dreamed how mistaken I would prove to be on the true nature of Swami Lokeshwarananda. I know because I lived in his presence, saw him day and night, and had morning tea with him daily for nearly 3 years. As so often happens in life, I did not properly value the situation at the time. Only now do I understand a little of my good fortune. It came about in this way. When Swami Yatishwarananda, my teacher, passed on only a month after I arrived, Swami Vireshwarananda, then General Secretary of the Order, came up to me on the Mott Monastery grounds one morning and said, "Well, now that you are here in India, why not occupy your time with some work?" I readily agreed, thinking of editing or even gardening, perhaps. "We have this educational institution at Narendrapur," he said, "and Swami Lokeshwarananda is requesting you as one of his teachers of English in the high school." "But Maharaj," I stuttered, "I've never taught school. I have no teaching credential. So, you speak English, don't you? So you can teach it," he said. And that was that. Swami Lokeshwarananda was a towering, imposing figure in the midst of a people of generally small stature. He was made even taller by his Belur Math cap. He greeted me on arrival at the ashrama with a bright smile and enthusiasm, and my reaction was a guarded one. We proceeded to the monk's quarters where he assigned me a room, leaving me in the care of another American brahmachari. I did not see the Swami again for a week. But eventually, it was my good fortune to be housed in the room next to his, where it was clear that he used the first hour of every day, like most of us, for prayer and meditation in his room. The room beyond his bedroom was a sort of office for him, where we two sat every morning for tea before breakfast. Vishakha, his grey and quite ordinary mother cat, would soon come in to be stroked. Swami would address her in the most warm and affectionate tones and ask her about her kittens. He had a pet deer, too, kept in a pen in the gardens. When he asked his attendant, Nimai, to bring in the tea and called out his name, it was said with such mellow affection, one could easily understand why he became one of the most loved monks of his time. Eventually, I learned that virtually every one of the 1,800 souls on those grounds knew and loved him. At the end of his work day, Kanai Maharaj, as he was familiarly called, would slowly walk through the setting sunlight back to his office room, where he would sit in an easy chair, relax, and do his evening meditation in the ensuing dusk. Over tea, Swami talked of many things. Of Paturyagata, the distinguished neighborhood where the institution had been started, of India's plight. He said he had studied the plight of India in the light of Swamiji's teachings and had come to the conclusion that the only place to begin was with education. Money would not do it, neither would the power of politics or agitation raise the country. He would relate the events of Indian history and details of the lives of its famous figures. It was an education just to listen to him. We did much comparing of Indian and Western mores. Of course, there were problems at school, which I had to put to him. Swami Lokeshwarananda could scold when necessary, but he did not often feel he had to, in my case. His constant complaint of me was, "You are always jumping to conclusions." Why was I so hasty and did not wait to see all sides of a thing? Worst was the case of the stolen watch. I had gone to shower, leaving my clothes and wristwatch on the bed, not far from an open window. When I came back to dress, the watch was missing. I went to the Swami, who was sitting in his office room, and complained. Of course, I expected that he would be as shocked as I and immediately order an investigation. "I am afraid the blame is on you," he said sternly. "Why did you leave something valuable in plain sight, thus tempting the boys to snatch it?" Totally taken aback, I could say nothing. He went on in that vein for some time, giving me much to ponder. How often it must be, when we are insulted and injured, that the opportunity for it starts with us. Of course, due search was made, the culprit found, and the watch returned, but I was never quite the same person after that. Swami Lokeshwarananda made special arrangements for his workers from abroad. There were two British teachers and another American novice. We were provided with good fans for our rooms, a special cook with special food. We ate our breakfast and supper apart in the fancy guest house, usually reserved for VIPs. Swami anticipated our needs and difficulties and saw to our comfort so far as he was able. He appointed a teacher to coach me in the Bengali language. When I became ill and had to spend 3 weeks in the little ashram hospital, he would visit me every few days, checking with the physician about my diet and progress, and he wrote a beautiful letter to my mother in America, telling her what was being done for me and extending to her his sympathy. That letter changed the whole relationship between my mother and me, softening her hostile attitude toward my way of life. She later wrote to me, "Well, if you have to be a monk, I guess you are in the best order in the world." Morning tea finished, we would go our separate ways to a short breakfast, and Swami would walk the long path to the ashram office building for his day's labor. I would hurry to my English classes at the school. Therefore, I was not able to see his administrative talent at first hand. I heard about it from others, who reported it to be generally superb, efficient, but also affectionate, exacting, but also forgiving. In fact, Swami Lokeshwarananda dealt with his large staff of secretaries, professors, teachers, principals, students, parents, drivers, and the other hired and volunteer servitors of the ashram in a manner I did not often see in India. If we were out with a car on an errand or a visit, at the end of the journey he would dismiss his driver with a thank you. And if a meal was involved, he would see that the man was fed just as we were. There was a large sheltering tree on the path from our quarters to the schools. One day Swami mentioned that the local workers and children believed that the tree was inhabited by a ghost, some evil spirit. He told it with a smile, but he never ridiculed such convictions. All this dignity of manner was true also toward the 8 or 9 boys of another culture who entered the school in 1966. It was the first year of a social and political experiment, bringing boys from the Northeast Frontier Agency, now called Arunachala Pradesh, into mainstream education at Narendrapur. Swami asked me to act as their local guardian, as it was called, and I have seldom had so great and challenging an experience. There were difficulties, and it made problems for him on top of all his others. But Swami Lokeshwarananda took these boys under his wing, and he tried his best to get them integrated into the general student body. I was to get acquainted with each one, to tutor them in English, and even in Bengali, and to forestall their homesickness as much as possible. Swami set me to studying the writings of Verrier Elwin, the tribal anthropologist and NAIFA specialist, and to making contact with the government agent in charge of the province affairs. Of course, there was a political agenda involved in this project. Christian missionaries had been working on the NAIFA people, trying to get them estranged from the Hindu culture and even independent of it. With regard to political activity, there were many challenges from the Naxalites, a political group nurtured on communism, even at this period, and many incidents. One day, Swami was suddenly called from his office to the eastern edge of the property, where some kind of altercation between our employees and a group of local troublemakers was going on. Much haranguing, all in Bengali, so it was lost to my ears, but when Maharaj appeared on the scene with his unhurried walk, his towering appearance and his calm presence, everyone fell silent. In undisturbed and mellow tones, he inquired into the matter. It seems this was a serious confrontation. I learned later that he had listened to all sides, treated all equally, and had neutralized a potential danger. The guest house at Narendrapur was quite an impressive structure for that time and place, featuring rare hardwoods and some marble, and Swami was quite proud of it. In addition to meals for the Westerners, it served to host the head of Calcutta's Institute of Culture, Swami Nitya Swarupananda, a frequent guest and one of Swami Lokeshwarananda's best friends. These two were very often seen walking the paths and chatting together. Swami Lokeshwarananda was always cherishing the hope that President Maharaj, Swami Vireshwarananda by this time, also would be able to get away from the mott, come and enjoy a few days of retreat at the guest house. Of course, it rarely, if ever, happened. Quite a number of brahmacharis had been assigned to Narendrapur. To these, Swami Lokeshwarananda allotted both arduous tasks and golden opportunities. He specifically mentioned to me the names of several whom he felt he had trained enough to take charge of centers or schools someday. That came to be true. I have described my Nepha assignment. Swami asked me to accompany the boys back to their own land for the puja holidays. In the following year's vacation, he sent me to Barloganj in the Himalayan foothills to visit my famous countryman, Gurudas Maharaj, Swami Atulananda. And on campus, there were talks to be given in school assembly or hostel meetings or to a college program in Calcutta. He gave me the singular honor of delivering the dedicatory speech for the opening of the newly constructed Vivekananda Hall. My room had a window which opened on a corridor. Every morning on his way to the washroom, Swami would say, "Good morning, Buddha Maharaj." And every night on his way to bed, "Good night, Buddha Maharaj." The reader may wonder why I mention such a simple thing, but those who have lived in that land will understand. One evening he called me from the office room. Caught by surprise, I answered, "Yes, Mother," without knowing why or how. I was shocked. I pondered, "Is that really how I think of him?" I was transferred away from India in 1969, and when I made a short visit back in 1971, Swami Nitya Swarupananda had passed away, and the leadership of the Institute of Culture had fallen to Swami Lokeshwarananda. It seemed appropriate, as they had been so close, and Kanai Maharaj's own education and culture was so obviously first rate. As I went to see him, I wondered how much he might be missing the life of that bustling complex at Narendrapur. But I saw no sign of that. He, immured in the heartland of Calcutta, was exercising his famous social and administrative talents. In the one weekend I spent at the Institute, it appeared that the larger world of associations which his new post entailed had affected neither his humility nor his regularity of life. Swami Lokeshwarananda made a trip to the West in 1989, visiting most of our centers as he went. When he reached the St. Louis Center, I went from Ganges, Michigan, to meet him. He was happy that I had come, and just as warm as I had expected. Readers will recall how I had misjudged this monk in my first observations. Only the subsequent close association for many days was able to pull aside the curtain of this lighted window. Then it was that the light shone out in glory. Even then I had not its full view. Many have spoken about their delayed recognition of spiritual attainment in others. How often we have heard, "What a pity that while she was living and I had her company, I failed to understand her greatness." Or, "If I had realized he was an illumined soul, I would have treated him so differently." In my case, with Swami Lokeshwarananda, I suspected from the day of our first true association that I was in the presence of a realized soul. The elevation of his mind shone out more through his daily dealings with the tremendous variety of persons in his busy life than in his speeches or writings. I think he must have thrown many off the track of his spiritual stature, just as it had been with me at first sight. The inner nature of many monks who are busy karma yogis does not manifest itself until they retire. But light cannot easily be hidden. Swami's inner nature did not openly appear until he retired. As I was not witness to this falling off of the veil, I rely here on the word of others who were. It happened in this way. He was paying a second visit to Vedantists in the West in 1995. A visit in which I unfortunately could not share. With the group in Vancouver, Canada, he was the very soul of affection. Listening to a song sung by a notable devotional singer, he closed his eyes and became so absorbed that he was hard to rouse. Devotees held his hand and chanted the name of the Lord. After a long time, he came to himself, and tears began to flow from Swami's eyes, and this continued for about 20 minutes. Though constantly wiped away, the tears kept right on coming and hardly stopped even when he was bundled into a car to be taken to his next engagement. There the Swami gave a talk on love. Here are two excerpts from letters he wrote to me when I had gone back to London. Narendrapur, 1972. I hope when you find more letters from or to Tontine, Josephine McLeod, you will send out the copies of them to people like us who are anxious to have any scrap of information that there is about the workings of Tontine's mind. I myself had many conversations with Tontine, and I vividly remember the glow of courage and confidence which surrounded her personality. Someday I hope to write about her, and when I do so, the letters you have sent me will prove immensely helpful. Narendrapur, 1975. It is unfortunate that this is how Maya operates. I am glad to know that blank has taken his present misfortune in his stride and is able to carry on as if nothing had happened. Nothing has indeed happened, except that he has learnt that it is not enough to be good. One must be cautious also. I agree that even if for subjective reasons one finds a place disagreeable, there is no harm if one tries to leave it. After all, one cannot change one's nature overnight. One may struggle for some time, but if one finds that to struggle is not worth the gain one is going to make, one is perfectly justified in running away from the place. I make all these comments only for my own sake, for I have been in many places and I have learnt that more often it is because of my own nature that I have been unhappy in some of them." End of quote. In our bookshops now, I see his Upanishad translations and commentaries on the Gita, on Sri Ramakrishna's life, the way to God, religion, and so on. When in the world did he find time to do all that? I knew nothing of it.